This is edition number 2026 of The Mardler, recorded in Aylsham on Friday, the 17th of July, 2026. Hello, you are listening to The Mardler, the weekly talking newspaper for North Norfolk. Today we bring you the week's news and views from the North Norfolk News of Thursday the 16th of July 2026. My name is Simon Musto-Arthur and my fellow readers are
John Hoyle,
Debs Hall
and Jeannie Marden.
On the notice board today, this week the sun will rise around 4:55 and will set at about 9:05.
The magazine supplement will follow a little later in the programme and includes how to grow things for tasting in the garden, National Trust tips on food conservation, a Norfolk man who knows his gorillas, and a fisherman at sea over a wind farm company's letters.
But we begin with the main news items, which include fires during the heatwave, the hosepipe ban in Norfolk, the tragic death of a walker at Felbrigg Hall, a U-turn on the Sheringham shelter, which sees its demolition as the final chapter and chapters of a different story, are to be filmed in and around Cromer. Let's start with those lead stories.
Norfolk Fire and Rescue Service responded to 31 incidents between Friday and Sunday, covering areas across the county from Goulston to King's Lynn and Wells to Diss. Crews dealt with fires in fields, woods, hedges, bushes, forests and grassed areas, as well as bins, bonfires and a campfire. A spokesman for Norfolk Fire and Rescue Service said, "Using what three words helped us to pinpoint remote locations quickly and minimise fire spread. Please download the app so you can help us arrive quickly if we are needed. The risk of wildfires is still high. Please stay vigilant, Norfolk, and take extra care as we head towards the school holidays." The two most significant incidents were a fire in Thorpe St Andrew and a 50 by 50 metre blaze at Thetford Forest. 10 crews were called to the fire in Hillcrest Road, Thorpe St Andrew, at around 4 p.m. on Sunday, with firefighters stood down by 8:30 p.m. The fire in Thetford Forest started at around 5:30 p.m. on the same day near Thetford Golf Club.
A large open fire that ripped through fields has left its mark on acres of land. The blaze broke out in Swanton Abbott Road near Swanton Abbott, south of North Walsham, at around 6 p.m. on Monday, July the 6th. Footage captured now shows the scale of the damage after the blaze, with acres of field left in black coating. The road was closed with crews from Aylsham, North Walsham, Stalham, Munsley, Wroxham, Sheringham and Cromer attending the scene. People were urged to avoid the area before the fire was put out over 4 hours later at 10:30 p.m. Norfolk Fire and Rescue is urging people to stay vigilant if they're out and about, as in this hot and dry weather, fires can spread quickly.
People in Norfolk and Suffolk are not allowed to use hosepipes to water gardens, clean vehicles or fill paddling pools under restrictions imposed by Anglian Water. The ban is the first of its kind in the region since 2012 due to the county's current third heatwave of the summer. However, people will still be allowed to use hosepipes for filling up ponds when protecting the health and safety of animals, fish and aquatic life. Hosepipes connected to a water butt or other recycled water storage system can also freely be used, and religious practices as well as specific business needs will also be exempt from the region's ban. The ban, however, does cover hot tubs, swimming pools and fountains, and the company says that breaching the ban could result in a fine of up to £1,000. It comes after the hottest ever June temperature recorded in Norfolk at 37.7 degrees Celsius in Lingwood. Dr. Jeff Darch, Head of Strategic Asset Planning at Anglian Water, said this year has been exceptionally hot and dry, and we're already into the third heat wave of the summer. Every day of sustained hot weather increases the challenge of balancing supply and demand, and we're now at the point where we need to ask customers to help by hanging up the hose pipe, letting lawns go brown, cars go dirty, and using water even more wisely to help protect the environment and ensure that water remains available for all customers. Exemptions from the hose pipe ban are animal welfare, health and safety, business needs, religious practices, using recycled water, new lawns, trickle irrigation systems, commercial watering, and new swimming pools.
A walker has died after being trampled by cattle at one of the National Trust's Norfolk estates. The tragedy unfolded at Felbrigg Hall at around 11:45 on Monday. Paramedics were called to the hall near Cromer, but the man, who was in his 70s, died at the scene. Following the death, the National Trust closed the site for the rest of the day, and it was shut all of Tuesday. A spokeswoman for the National Trust said, "Emergency services were called to the parkland at Felbrigg Hall on Monday the 13th of July after a member of the public was seriously injured while walking. Despite the efforts of the paramedics, the person tragically died at the scene. We are shocked and deeply saddened by this news, and our thoughts and condolences are with their family and friends at this incredibly difficult time. As an investigation is underway, we are unable to comment further." A spokesman for Norfolk Constabulary said the man's next of kin had been informed. He added, "Officers are investigating alongside colleagues from the Health and Safety Executive. The man is believed to have been walking on the grounds when the incident occurred. The sprawling estate's grounds include a lake and 520 acres of woods. There is public access to the grounds along a number of waymarked walks through the property, including the Weaver's Way long-distance footpath. The Health and Safety Executive estimates that cattle kill an average of 4 to 5 people per year in Britain, making them the most deadly animal behind dogs. Most victims are said to be farmers or walkers who are attacked by cows protecting their calves. Felbrigg Hall was built during the 17th century and was donated to the National Trust in 1969 by Robert Wyndham Ketton Kremer."
A beloved 1950s bus shelter that was the subject of a long-running battle to save it has been ripped down. The structure on Station Approach in Sheringham was demolished yesterday morning as part of a £580,000 transport hub scheme led by Norfolk County Council. The controversial move to knock down the shelter faced unrelenting opposition from campaigners who staged a 9-day sit-in protest last December to try and save it. They argued that the shelter, known for its steam train mural, could be adapted or retained at a lower cost. Sheringham Town Council initially voted to save the shelter from demolition at an emergency meeting. However, the council made a U-turn in June, arguing that knocking it down was the most economical option available. Work to demolish the shelter began on Monday, with a digger pulling down the shelter with fencing in place around the area. 2 days before, locals gathered to say a final goodbye to the much-loved 1950s bus shelter. On Saturday, a crowd had assembled near the shelter, which sits in front of Ottendorf Green, with some placing hearts and messages on the structure, and others joining in chants of "Leave it proudly standing" as part of a final act of protest. Liz Withingham, a district and county councillor, speaking at the scene, described the moment as a sad day, adding that the project had failed to reflect local priorities. Ms. Withingham said, "It's been a long ongoing saga, but for me it's more than just a bus shelter. This stretch of road here isn't an accident black spot. The junction at the end of Waterbank Road is. We've had 3 accidents here since Christmas that have required emergency services. There were other options given, and they weren't just options that people pulled out of the sky. They were projects that qualified highway engineers looked at and considered and said yes, it was possible. The councillor also criticised what she called a culture of Little Britain, really, where the computer says no all the time. She added, there was no real listening, there was no real consideration given, no actually trying to amend things, change things, and make things work for the town. Campaigners have previously argued the shelter could have been retained or adapted at a lower cost, while supporters of the transport hub scheme, including the town's mayor, Sue Brisbane, said the redevelopment will improve accessibility and support the wider town centre.
North Norfolk Railway has reported a drop in passenger numbers and profits despite making a landmark anniversary year. In its latest annual report, the railway recorded a profit of £81,000 for the year ending January the 31st, 2026, down from £208,000 the previous year. Last year, the Heritage Line, which runs between Sheringham and Holt, celebrated 50 years since reopening in 1975. The annual report also shows passenger numbers fell by 9%, from 143,000 in 2024 to 129,000 last year. Turnover for the year stood at £4 million, with 66 permanent staff supporting operations. Despite the challenges, 2025 was described as a significant year for the railway. Two locomotives joined the fleet, including Hunslet, Newstead, which steamed for the first time in more than 50 years and hauled its first passenger trains during anniversary celebrations. Locomotive 880 also joined the North Norfolk Railway. In September, Weybourne and Sheringham stations were granted Grade 2 listed status by Historic England, recognising their historic importance. The statement said, being recognised in this way is a proud moment for the line and a tribute to the volunteers and staff that have cared for the structures since the line closed in 1964. The railway hosted a reunion of volunteers who helped save the line in the 1960s and 70s, which was held exactly 50 years after the first public service ran on July the 13th, 1975. However, rising costs continue to pose difficulties. The report highlights high prices for coal, diesel and oil, driven in part by conflict in the Middle East, as well as increasing wage and regulatory pressures. The statement said, our strategy to providing exceptional quality, value for money, opportunities for customers to trade up, and maximising secondary spend has continued to deliver. However, cost of living pressures amongst customers are a threat.
Great Yarmouth is in the running to become the first ever UK town of culture and is among the 15 shortlisted contenders. Almost 400 places from across the country entered the landmark competition. The town's submission highlighted its medieval rose, maritime heritage and community celebrations. It described itself as a town of pride, imagination and resilience, where historic traditions sit alongside ambitious plans for the future. The shortlisting comes after the Great Yarmouth and Lowestoft failed 2021 joint bid to be named UK City of Culture 2025. Unsuccessful bids across Norfolk and Suffolk included Cromer and Sheringham's joint entry, Lowestoft, Fakenham, Wells, Aylsham, North Walsham, Thetford and the Waveney Valley, which included Beccles, Bungay, Diss, Eye, Halesworth and Harleston. Great Yarmouth has been selected in the medium towns category. The other nominees are Corby, Leith, Pontypridd and Port Talbot. Shortlisted towns will now receive £60,000 each to develop their full bids, which will be assessed by the independent judging panel. From the 15 shortlisted towns, the independent panel will recommend the best small, medium and large town from the full applications they receive. An overall winner from these three towns will be designated the UK Town of Culture 2028 and receive a £3 million grant from the government. The additional two towns from the other two categories will be selected as finalists and receive £250,000 each to carry out their part of the programme.
A book about a running club for women with cancer is to be turned into a major film, which will be shot in Cromer. Josie Lloyd's 2023 novel, The Cancer Ladies Running Club, is due to be filmed in the town later this year. The production, which is being backed by North Norfolk District Council, will star Maxine Peake, who starred in Shameless and Dinner Ladies, and Gemma Jones, who appeared in the Bridget Jones and Harry Potter films. The council is giving in-kind support to the production. This means the authority will be helping through resources rather than direct cash. This could entail road closures, access to council facilities and staff time. Councillors believe the film will generate tourism in the town and agreed to back it at a meeting on Monday. No information was made public about the amount of support or identity of the film. However, details about the production have since emerged. It is due to be called The Bright Side Running Club, the title of the book when it was published in the USA. The book tells the story of Kira, a 40-something mother of three and successful businesswoman. Her life starts to unravel when she is diagnosed with breast cancer. She embraces running and joins a running club for a group of women going through treatment for the same condition. The production was first launched at the Cannes Film Festival earlier this year. Lloyd is to adapt the script from her own book, while Cherie Folkson, whose credits include Bridgerton and Doctor Who, is set to direct. Jones starred as Bridget Jones's mother in the film series and as Hogwarts matron, Madame Poppy Pomfrey, in the Harry Potter movies. Peake, who has received BAFTA nominations, played Myra Hindley in ITV's See No Evil, The Moors Murders. Council documents state that the town should expect additional income while the shoot is actually taking place, and then again when the film airs, as it raises the profile of the resort. Other productions to film in Cromer include Alpha Papa, the 2013 Alan Partridge film, and the BBC's The Running Grave, based on the Robert Galbraith, J.K. Rowling novels. Houseful 3, a 2016 Bollywood hit, also shot a large dance scene on the pier.
Our next few stories involve issues around vandalism, inappropriate decorating of graves, a new royal family for Cromer Carnival, through to crop harvesting news, a primary school closure, the state of children's teeth in Norfolk, and the analysis of the results of a local by-election.
A putting green in a coastal town has had to close due to repeated vandalism. Sheringham Putting Green has confirmed it will be shut until further notice due to ongoing issues. The series of incidents reportedly involved children who have been damaging the area. A spokesman for the site said police are now increasing patrols in the area and working to identify those responsible. Over the past 2+ months, we have arrived on site to broken benches, constant littering, foul language, evidence of fires being lit, an attempted break-in of the council cleaning shed, a bench stolen, and now this, the spokesman said. Anyone who witnesses antisocial behaviour on the site is urged to contact police. The closure comes shortly after North Norfolk councillor Liz Withington urged parents to take more responsibility for their children amid growing concerns over antisocial behaviour in Sheringham. The warning followed reports of large groups of teenagers and young adults gathering on the putting green, with incidents including alcohol use, littering, and disruptive behaviour. Locals have also reported broken glass on the beach near the lifeboat station, excessive noise, and abuse directed at nearby homeowners.
An outdoor gym has been forced to close until further notice after it was targeted by vandals. The facility was recently installed at Holt Country Park as part of a major £100,000 project. The site also features a community classroom and eco-learning space designed to teach visitors about sustainability and the environment. When used, the gym can generate energy to power the building's lights and charge devices. However, photos posted to social media on Wednesday, July the 8th, showed damage to each of the mobile phone chargers. A spokesman for North Norfolk District Council, NNDC, said the gym equipment will be out of action until replacement parts are installed. They added, "Senseless acts of vandalism like this cost the taxpayers money and create unnecessary work. We aim to get them back in use as soon as possible." The site was built after NNDC was awarded a grant from offshore wind farm developer Ørsted. The grant is part of the Danish energy company's Horsey 3 Legacy Fund, which will distribute £7 million over the next 10 years.
A series of inspections is set to take place at Cromer's Town Cemetery to remove broken or unsightly items. Cromer Town Council has announced it will carry out inspections starting on Friday, July the 17th. Removed items will be labelled, with families given a six-month window to reclaim any belongings. The council has reiterated several rules governing what can and cannot be placed on graves and cremation plots. Breakable items such as glass, ceramic and terracotta are not permitted due to safety concerns and may be removed without notice if deemed a risk. Similarly, objects that emit light, sound or movement, including windmills, balloons, wind chimes and solar-powered lights or candles, are banned to protect the cemetery's peaceful atmosphere. Restrictions are particularly strict for cremation plots, where only flowers placed in inset vases are allowed. Exceptions are made for Christmas wreaths and flowers immediately following the interment of ashes. Christmas wreaths should be removed by the end of February, and funeral wreaths must be taken away within 4 weeks of a service. Items left beyond these periods will be removed by the council.
A new royal family has been crowned in Cromer to signal the start of this year's much-anticipated carnival season. Carnival Queen Naomi Bushell leads the 2026 lineup, joined by senior attendant Sarah Woods, Prince Henry Broughton, Princess Freya Veazey, and junior attendants Freddie Boyer and Hayley Chatton. The group gathered at North Lodge Park for their first official photographs, a long-standing tradition that marks the countdown to carnival celebrations. Dressed in striking blue, the royal party posed formal images before relaxing into more informal shots. This starts the packed programme of events, processions and community festivities of Cromer Carnival. The Carnival Week will be held from Saturday, August the 15th to Friday, August the 21st, with Carnival Day on Wednesday, August the 19th. Last year, the carnival took a new route, but after a public questionnaire, this year's parade will revert to the original route and finish on the carnival field. This should reduce the need for extra traffic marshals.
After the June heatwave hastened the harvest, the combines rolled onto the fields at the Saul Estate near Reefham, this year's winner of the coveted Norfolk Farm Business Competition. Estate manager Andrew Peel said his first crop to be harvested was seed barley, whose yields are down by as much as 20% in extremely challenging conditions. "We're not surprised with the yields, and that's probably because we've had 60% of our average rainfall in the key growing months, April, May and June, compared to the average of the last 5 years. And that also includes 2022, which was obviously a very dry year as well," he said. "So we're down on rainfall, but also we experienced unprecedented levels of wheat dwarf virus in the barley crop, which is spread by leafhoppers. That really caused quite a lot of damage to our crops in the autumn. We've been aware of the virus for probably the last 8 to 10 years, but we've never seen it in levels like this. It's affecting barley crops in general, but the worst affected are the ones that are drilled early, and we're learning how to compensate for this. Despite the early results, Mr. Peel said there were still reasons for optimism, with the hot weather bringing ideal harvest conditions for the seed barley, and hopes for better yields from the farm's malting barley, oilseed rape, and wheat crops, which will be gathered in the coming weeks. The flip side is that we've managed to harvest it all dry, he said. I am optimistic about the malting barley and how the wheat is looking, because it's on the stronger land. He added, as farmers, we're always known as moaning, and the weather's never, never right for us. But it's incredibly challenging conditions all round.
Consultation has started over new catchment areas for pupils following the confirmed closure of a Norfolk school. Corpusty Primary School will shut its doors in September after a fall in pupil numbers, dropping from 103 in 2015-16 to just 31 in the current academic year. Synergy Multi-Academy Trust, which runs the school in the village between Aylsham and Holt, announced plans for closure in January. The Department for Education rubber-stamped the amalgamation of Corpusty with Reefham Primary School last month. The joint consultation run by Norfolk County Council and Synergy proposes the Corpusty Primary School catchment area will not be allocated in its entirety to Reefham Primary School. The northern portion will be added to the catchment area for Astley Primary School in Briston and the southern to the catchment area for Reefham Primary School. Officials say that will support fairness, sustainability of pupil numbers, and access to local schools for children and families. Both schools already feed into Reefham High School, so secondary pathways will remain unchanged. If approved, the changes will take effect from September. Officials said, "It's an interim step to provide clarity for families. We will, however, continue to keep catchment arrangements under review." Campaigners, including North Norfolk Liberal Democrat MP Stephen Aquarone, had argued that planned housing developments in Corpusty could increase future pupil numbers and called for a reconsideration of the closure. But Georgina Gould, Minister for School Standards, said, "Having considered the evidence carefully and the options available, we believe that this amalgamation is necessary and that pupils will benefit from being taught in the amalgamated school in Reefham. Synergy intends to create a dedicated, special educational needs and disabilities school at the Corpusty site."
More schools could hold sessions where youngsters brush their teeth, after a new report showed about 1 in 5 young children in Norfolk have tooth decay or are missing teeth. An oral health survey found 21.3% of 5-year-olds in the county have dental decay, close to the England average of 22.4%, but significantly above the East of England average of 17.5%. Norfolk County Council public health officers revealed the parts of the county with the highest proportion of tooth decay. Among those youngsters included Norwich, King's Lynn, Great Yarmouth and Thetford. The authority already works with other health organisations to provide supervised toothbrushing sessions in dozens of Norfolk schools and early years providers. And public health chiefs, drawing up a new strategy to tackle oral health across all ages, say expanding that scheme could make a major difference. It was discussed at a meeting of County Hall Adult Social Care and Public Health Committee on Wednesday, July the 8th. Sarah James, Public Health Registrar, told councillors, "There's a scheme called supervised toothbrushing which we have in Norfolk and we're scaling that up with some government investment. That's where classes of children all brush their teeth together once a day to promote toothbrushing. It's been shown to be really effective. For every pound you spend on it, you get back about £3 in savings." Norfolk County Council's officials said expanding the scheme could make a major difference as part of a wider oral health strategy, acknowledging Norfolk as a dental desert with a lack of NHS dentists. They told councillors they are keen to influence that, but they said that was a matter mainly for the NHS and the Integrated Care Board, so the Public Health Department's emphasis had to be on prevention. The oral health strategy, due to be finalised later this year, is also likely to include campaigns to encourage people to limit sugary food and to highlight how smoking can contribute to gum disease and oral cancers.
A 20-year-old has swept to a landslide victory in a Norfolk by-election to become the youngest councillor in the county. Tyler Ragg's win in Suffield Park Ward has ensured the Liberal Democrats keep their 26-seat stronghold on North Norfolk District Council. The victory, in what is the first of a string of by-elections in the county this summer, saw Mr. Ragg take 485 votes, 65% of the total. The vote, which was held on Thursday, has restored the political makeup of NNDC to 26 Lib Dems, 11 Conservatives and 3 Independents. The by-election was triggered by a resignation. Reform UK's Benjamin Miles came second with 136 votes, 18%. Conservative candidate John Lee took 88 votes. Green candidate Paul Sutcliffe received 20 votes, while Labour's David Russell got 13. Turnout was 35.4% from a total of 742 votes cast. Following his win, Mr. Ragg said, "I'm so grateful to all of the residents who voted in this by-election, and I'm overwhelmed at the result we've seen this evening." Mr. Ragg, who was born in Cromer, previously sat on NNDC's Youth Council, takes over from Mrs. Took, who had served on the council since 2019 and was known locally as the Norfolk Loo Lady, after a campaign she led for more accessible public toilets. More by-elections are set to follow across the county this summer. Next Thursday, voters go to the polls to elect a new police and crime commissioner at a cost of £2 million. This follows the resignation of Sarah Taylor. Ms. Taylor was also a Breckland councillor, meaning a second vote will be held on the same day to fill that seat. A further election will also be held on the same day for a county council seat in Old Catton, after Reform councillor Mark Tucker quit just 25 days into the role, citing ill health. Later in the summer, votes will also be held at West Norfolk Council following the resignations of Conservative councillors Andrew Jamieson and Stuart Dark. You are listening to edition number 2026 of The Mardler, recorded on Friday the 17th of July 2026. Still to come are changes afoot at Mawston Quays, new digital displays at train stations, rare Chinese candlesticks appear in Norfolk, warnings about unsolicited callers, and celebrations for a retired postman, and of course The Mardler magazine. But before all of that, here are some articles about local events and establishments to tempt you out and about in your area.
The Holt Bookshop's 6th annual Now We Are 6 event will run from July the 25th to August the 1st and promises a full programme of performance, film and literary discussion in and around Holt. 17 events will take place across the week, including a special focus on women's fiction, an afternoon dedicated to crime writing, and the world premiere of a narrative concert. Pam and Keith Britton, owners of the Holt Bookshop, said, "We have never felt more excited about what we are offering." On July the 31st, St Andrew's Church in Holt will host the world premiere of You Must Change Your Life, a narrative concert marking the centenary of the poet Rainer Maria Rilke's death and the 150th anniversary of artist Gwen John's birth. It is written and composed by Tony Britton, with music by Debussy and Sarti. That same day will also feature the UK premiere of a Rilke documentary at the Holt Community Centre. The literary lineup includes appearances by Sarah Hall, Claire Daverley, Claire Lynch, Wendy Holden, Melissa Harrison, Sarah Byatt and Kieran Millwood Hargrave, with each event priced at £8. Crime fiction fans are invited to Holt Community Centre on July the 29th for talks by author Peter Granger, Rob Parker and Tim Sullivan. Other highlights include a film screening of The Man Who Fell to Earth and Dancing with Darcy, a narrative recital inspired by the life and works of Jane Austen. The full programme is available at Holt Bookshop, .co.uk/6th.
Bounce Town will visit Hoveton Village Hall's playing field from Thursday, August the 20th to Sunday, August the 23rd, and will feature a variety of activities for children and families to enjoy. The event near Wroxham runs during the school summer holidays and aims to provide an affordable and community-focused 4 days of entertainment. Families can purchase a 3-hour session ticket, which includes access to the inflatables, children's games and entertainment. Character meet and greets will also take place, in addition to there being a range of options for food and drink. An organiser said, "We're passionate about creating a welcoming community-focused event that gives local families something exciting to enjoy close to home. We hope Bounce Town will become a memorable highlight of the summer holidays while also supporting local businesses and bringing visitors into the Hoveton area."
A dramatic reading of Jane Austen's Sense and Sensibility will be held on August 2nd from 3 p.m. to 5 p.m. at Cromer Hall, the inspiration for Arthur Conan Doyle's Baskerville Hall, and will feature live classical music, a cream tea and a themed raffle. Tickets are £25 and include entry to the reading and refreshments. The event will raise funds for Hospice Ethiopia UK, which supports Hospice Ethiopia in Addis Ababa, providing medical, financial and mental support. Sue Mumford, Chair of Hospice Ethiopia UK, said, "We are so grateful to Benji and Dido for lending us their wonderful home. It's an ideal venue for a drama, providing a stunning, iconic backdrop. Events like this are so important for Hospice Ethiopia, not only for fundraising, but also to help raise our profile and get our message across." This is the fourth Jane Austen reading hosted by the charity, with previous events proving popular with audiences. Tickets are limited. To book, email info@hospiceethiopia.org.uk.
Chandlery in Wells, the first restaurant from award-winning sommelier and maitre d' Bert Blaise, launched at the beginning of May. Now the restaurant has been awarded 2 AA Rosettes for culinary excellence, thought to be a first for the town, to the delight of its team. A restaurant spokesman said, "It's official. After just 6 weeks, we're thrilled to announce Chandlery Wells has been awarded 2 rosettes for culinary excellence from AA rated trips, a first for Wells next to sea. A huge thank you to our incredible team and everyone who supported our new restaurant." The food is led by head chef Harry Williams, whose experience includes the Gin Trap Inn, which held 3 AA rosettes during his tenure, as well as Number 29 and the Stookie Red Lion. Mr. Blaise opened North Norfolk Cellars, a wine shop and bar, at the site in 2024. He was named the UK's best sommelier under 30 in 2019 and has published 2 books on wine.
2 North Norfolk fish and chip shops have been named among the best in the country. Number 1 in Cromer and French's in Wells have both been included in the Times annual list of the UK's best spots for the seaside staple. Writers at the publication commended Number 1 for its range of options, with its 2 dine-in restaurant areas and a takeaway. They described it as the best fish and chips in Cromer and said there were queues for all 3 options. Last year, it was named in the top 10 fish and chip shops in the country in the National Fish and Chip Awards 2026. French's in Wells was listed for its epic fish and chips, which the writer said formed queues outside the shop. William Thomas French opened the Chippy in 1921, and the quayside shop has been run since 1984 by his grandson, Marcus, who has worked there since he was seven. It won the Quality Accreditation Champion category at the National Fish and Chip Awards in 2024.
Two restaurants in Norfolk have been named among the top 100 in the country. Fino in Cromer ranked 17th, and Pips in Norwich was placed at 70th, and have been included in the Good Food Guide's list of Britain's 100 Best Local Restaurants 2026. The awards, now in their 16th year, celebrate the community-driven restaurants that offer value for money and top-quality cooking in a relaxed setting. Earlier this year, Fino made the top 12 of the guide list of the most brilliant neighbourhood bistros. Chloe Hamilton, head of reviews and listings at the Good Food Guide, said, "In the face of adversity, creativity has flourished in unusual and unlikely places. It has been hugely rewarding to see how these tiny operations are offering understanding quality in a way that so clearly strikes a chord with the local crowd. Arrive with an open mind and a good appetite, and you'll be brilliantly rewarded." Topping the list was La Locanda in Gisburn, Lancashire. The winners were announced at an awards ceremony at Theatre Royal, Drury Lane in London, on Monday morning.
A festival is set to receive a major boost after it secured a headline sponsor from across the Atlantic Ocean. Reefham Festival's Finbar Force stage will be supported by TTIKR, a creative platform founded by American music producer Pooh Bear. The platform rewards users for original video content and aims to give artists a global audience. Tom Crisp, Reefham Festival Director, said, "We are absolutely thrilled to welcome TTIKR as sponsor of our main stage. Having a platform created by one of the world's most successful music producers supporting a grassroots festival in Norfolk is incredibly exciting. It perfectly reflects what Reefham Festival is all about, giving artists a stage, celebrating creativity and connecting local talent with global opportunities." TTIKR was launched by American music producer Pooh Bear, best known for working with artists including Justin Bieber, Usher, Mariah Carey and Ed Sheeran. Scottish entrepreneur and TTIKR founder Stephen Hughes said TTIKR was created to give creators more opportunities to benefit from the content they produce. Reefham Festival is on August the 8th and 9th. Visit reefhamfestival.co.uk.
Swanton Abbott Play Park has been given a new lease of life, with months of fundraising and planning leading to an upgrade of the community space. The park now features exciting new play equipment, accessible servicing, a sensory and wildlife garden, a new multi-use ball area and comfortable seating. The upgrades were funded through donations from the public and a £65,000 charitable investment. Volunteers are also being sought to help maintain the new sensory and wildlife areas. A public opening celebration will take place on Saturday, July the 19th, from 10:30 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. Attendees can enjoy a refreshment stall with proceeds supporting ongoing park maintenance. The association is also interested in hearing from people who want to use the space to run events, activities and projects.
We now turn to this week's Mardler magazine supplement, where we hear of a gorilla safari and from the North Norfolk fishermen who are at sea over instructions to cease fishing from a Norwegian energy company. Also of growing tasty plants in our gardens and how to make the most of our food leftovers. There's also more from our roving reporter Beverly and Mardler listener Arthur about times gone by.
And the first article is from the North Norfolk News of the 18th of June 2026. Silverback gorillas are one of the most majestic sights in nature, and also one of the most mysterious. Now, thanks to a Norfolk man, people can get up close to the magnificent male apes and their female companions in their natural African habitat. Phil Nolan, from Gresham in North Norfolk, runs a specialist safari company that brings tourists face to face with endangered mountain gorillas in Uganda and Rwanda. The former British Army officer who studied at the University of East Anglia and is turning 40 is travelling to Uganda twice a year to lead mountain expeditions. He has travelled to 82 countries, but fell in love with Uganda and its wildlife after first visiting in 2021. He said, "I've come to love the peace and stillness of being with the animals in Uganda. There's something quite soul-soothing about being so close to wild animals and seeing how they do life. We can learn a lot from them, but we need to, and we must protect them." Wildlife Adventure Safaris focuses on mountain gorillas because they are concentrated in East and Central Africa. Mr. Nolan said, "Seeing the silverback in real life is a truly humbling experience. I know that as soon as I've experienced it, I need to get more people to feel that same feeling." Although living in Dubai, Mr. Nolan still misses the Norfolk village he grew up in. With his parents still in Gresham, he visits home often. He said, "More and more, I miss the pace of life in Norfolk. It's a settling thought to know that home life continues uninterrupted." The silverback is a mature male gorilla who has reached a point in his life where the hair on his back turns greyish white or silver. Silverback gorillas can weigh up to 300 to 500 pounds and stand around 5.6 feet high, with their bite force being around 1300 psi, exceeding that of lions. Some studies have estimated that gorillas could lift up to 10 times their body weight, making them 10 times stronger than the average human. David Attenborough famously sat with baby gorillas in a forest clearing in Rwanda in a BBC wildlife show. The footage for his 1979 Life on Earth series entranced the audience and remains one of his most iconic moments. The Ebola outbreak remains a worry for Mr. Nolan and his guides, but as of yet has not directly impacted the safari's areas. Mr. Nolan said the greatest risk is the implications of various travel restrictions and bans, rather than the risk of transmission of the disease. Wildlife Adventure Safaris has risk management and safety measures in place for tourist violence and kidnapping. Mr. Nolan worked in International SOS, a global medical and security assistance company, after leaving the army, providing him with the needed expertise. He added, "We take our duty of care very seriously and prioritise safety over our commercial bottom line. The greatest risk is road travel, and we assure that we have the best vetted guides, highest standard of vehicles, and understood protocols to help prevent an accident, but also to react to an accident if it occurs."
An article from the North Norfolk News of the 18th of June 2026. A group of Norfolk fishermen are facing a High Court showdown with an offshore energy company trying to force them out of waters where their families have fished for generations. Equinor, the Norwegian firm behind the Sheringham Shoal and Dudgeon wind farms, wants the court to order them to stay out of an area off the county coast so it can carry out a four-week survey. The fishermen learned of the legal action when they went to their boats on June the 12th to find legal papers zip-tied to the hulls. The claim had been brought against the North Norfolk Fishermen Society and its chairman, John Davis, an eighth-generation seafarer who has worked the waters off Cromer for 50 years. The society has 21 members, many of whom have fished off the coast for decades. Around six of the group arrived at their boats kept on the beach between Clye and Cromer in the early hours of June the 12th to find the legal notices attached. An initial High Court hearing on the same day was adjourned after the judge decided to grant the injunction and asked for further information about the nature and legal status of the Fishermen's Society. Another hearing was listed for yesterday. Mr. Davis, 60, said, "It seems to be a large company trying to work us out of the way. We've been doing this for generations. Might isn't always right." Equinor, which is a majority owned by the Norwegian government, turned over more than $76 billion in 2024 and employs around 25,000 people worldwide. The company says the work, which will see a survey of the seabed carried out to check for unexploded Second World War ordnance, is essential ahead of construction work to extend its wind farms. It says fishing gear and ropes in the area risk becoming entangled with its survey vessel, and that legal action was sought only as a last resort, after attempts to reach agreement with the fishing fleet failed. Mr. Davis said he'd already been forced to relocate his gear once before to make way for another wind farm run by Ørsted. He said if he had to move it again, it would reduce the catch for other fishermen already using those waters. "I don't want to move and halve someone else's fishing," he said. "It's putting fishermen against fishermen. I want to be going to sea. I've missed several days for meetings now. The stress and strain of it just isn't something we want hanging over our heads. We're traditional Norfolk businesses. We support the local industry, tourists, hotels. It's hard enough making a living out there as it is with the weather and everything else." The two sides first met in December 2025 when Equinor outlined its survey program to the Fishing Society. Fishermen say they heard little from the company until just before Easter, when they were asked to identify where their gear was and consider compensation offers. The two parties met again in late April, and a mediation session facilitated by the National Federation of Fishermen's Organisations followed in early May. Agreement was reached on principles for further cooperation, but not on the removal of gear for this particular survey. Steph Aquarone, the Lib Dem North Norfolk MP, who has previously called for more offshore wind farms, said he was supporting the fishermen. "I'm really alarmed by the speed at which this Norwegian giant has taken a group of mostly independent fishers straight to the High Court," he said. A spokesman for Equinor said, "We recognise the importance of fishing activity in the area and remain committed to working constructively with the local fishing community to agree a practical way forward. Our priority is to carry out the survey work safely and efficiently, in a manner that supports coexistence with the fishing community and meets the requirements set out in the project's development consent order. We will continue to engage in open, collaborative dialogue to find a timely solution."
In Gardener's World magazine, May 2026, Arit Anderson wrote, "When I ask people about their first garden memories, they are often related to taste, picking strawberries directly from the plant, eating a tomato from a grandparent's greenhouse, or being given a raw carrot as a snack from an allotment. We can recall the taste and where we were in a heartbeat. There is some science to understand why this is so. As our food hits the taste buds on our tongue, they send information to a part of our brain called the gustatory cortex. Whilst this part is processing the different tastes, it simultaneously links to our memory. This is so we can remember what we like or have an aversion to, and if the recall is good, then the next taste evokes the associated nostalgia. A sense of well-being associated with taste and memories is something we can all gain from our gardens. The marvel of growing anything from seed, the nurturing, is what most gardeners love. But to grow, harvest and literally taste the fruits of our labour brings more joy than anything else. There is an incredible sense of achievement that in itself is good for our well-being. Of course, Mother Nature bears a huge responsibility for making our produce taste so good. It starts with a healthy soil full of good microbes and nutrients that are transported through the roots into the plant. Good soil can hold moisture, which fruit, vegetables and herbs need to swell and ripen. And the right level of sunlight means that photosynthesis in the leaves produces the sugar to energise the plant, which can directly affect the flavour. Sun increases the sweetness of blackberries or tomatoes and intensifies pigments such as anthocyanins that give the redness to apples associated with good flavour and nutritional value. The fruit and veg you buy may be sprayed with insecticides, stored for long periods, or travel hundreds of miles to reach your plate, activities that diminish nutrients. But if you're only going a few steps outside and picking fresh produce in the quantity you need, then the taste is better. As a rule, the longer the vegetable, fruit or herb can stay attached to its parent plant, the healthier it will be for you. On top of this, there are certain varieties of vegetables, known as heritage or heirloom, which are now much revered by home growers. They are noted for their performance on flavour, taste and nutritional value over the modern varieties bred for aesthetic uniformity and shelf life. Heritage seeds are adapted to local conditions that help them perform and give superior flavour and taste. To get the best taste of any edible, eat it in season and better still, keep it local, as this is where it will be at its best. Local seasonal fruit and vegetables can be picked when they are at peak ripeness, so the flavour and texture are optimal. If you like certain varieties, another way to experience this is with cut and come again leaf crops, such as salads, spinach and leafy herbs. Sow once, then keep trimming the leaves as they grow. You can get many meals from one plant, and once they stop sprouting, you sow again. Spring provides fresh, delicate young leaves, asparagus shoots, and the first broad beans, while in summer we savour sweet garden peas, creamy new potatoes, crisp fennel, and the sweetness of berries and tomatoes, and the refreshing crunch of cucumbers and peppers. As the light decreases in autumn, we celebrate harvests, enjoying earthy root vegetables with cabbage, kale, and Brussels sprouts, which all favour the cooler weather, plus apples and pears for desserts. In winter, we can still enjoy starch-filled potatoes, leafy greens such as spinach, chard and rocket, which ranges from mild to peppery, and keep using apple varieties that slowly sweeten as they continue to ripen in dark storage. Don't be overwhelmed by thinking you need a huge allotment to grow these seasonal delights. You can pack taste into your garden to suit its size. Herbs sit well in borders, offering ornamental as well as culinary value. Salad leaves can be grown in a window box, and edible flowers such as nasturtiums sit nicely among perennials. Even dahlia petals can be sprinkled on a salad. And with so many dwarf varieties of fruit and veg, there is something for every balcony or patio. Bountiful crops can be preserved through drying, freezing or pickling for the leaner months ahead. It's great to have our edibles close to the house. Even brushing past herbs such as mint, thyme and fennel can release their aromatic scents. And with our sense of smell so closely entwined with our sense of taste, taking a sniff of our favourite edibles can awaken our taste buds. Growing edibles is a great way to involve all the family in gardening, especially children. Picking tasty leaves, fruits and veggies is exciting for their young minds and tummies. Staying in the moment is vital for mindfulness, and there is no better place than your garden for taking time to stop, pick and savour the flavour of whatever you've grown.
This article is from the National Trust magazine of spring 2025, written by Sophie Kershaw. Reducing the amount of food wasted at home is key to the fight against climate change. Here we look to the past for examples of kitchen thrift and ask chefs for their advice on transforming leftover ingredients into dishes worth celebrating. The first instalment of Mrs. Beaton's Book of Household Management was published in 1861, and Isabella Beaton offered some stern advice. Great care should be taken that nothing is thrown away or suffered to be wasted in the kitchen, which might, by proper management, be turned into good account. In the days before supermarkets and fridge freezers, our ancestors had an approach to cookery and kitchen management that was beholden to the seasons and with one eye firmly on the budget. They sought to stretch ingredients as far as possible, smoking or salting meat and fish, pickling or brining vegetables, curing excess milk into ripe cheese, and boiling gluts of summer fruit into jam or fermenting into alcohol. Ingredients flowed from one meal to the next, and it was standard practice for yesterday's lunch to be transformed into tomorrow's supper. The approach was often down to need. When you attribute more value to food, you're less likely to waste it, explained food historian Eleanor Barnett. The more you research the past, the more you begin to appreciate how much effort ordinary people put into producing food for their tables, growing, nurturing and harvesting it, and in the absence of artificial refrigeration, preserving it too. Currently, a third of all food produced globally goes to waste, and food waste accounts for 8 to 10% of global greenhouse gas emissions. By creatively thinking about leftover ingredients, the Trust is working to minimise the impact of our cafes on the environment. Each year we save nearly 600 tonnes of food waste from potentially entering landfill, says development chef Clive Goodacourt. We're working with sustainable waste companies to responsibly dispose of waste food and milk from our cafes, which is then converted into green energy and biofuel. Some of our places are repurposing spent coffee grounds as a nutrient-rich addition to garden compost, or offering bags for visitors to take home to add to their soil. And at Trust Cafes this spring, you can sample double chocolate pistachio and sea salt cookies made from leftover chocolate eggs from Easter trails, and bread and butter pudding made from leftover fruit scones. Plenty of the ingredients we still use today have their origins in leftovers of the past. When you look at recipe books from history, you start to think of leftovers as something exciting and transforming, says Eleanor. People were creative by necessity and came up with amazing ways of reimagining ingredients. Did you know that golden syrup was created from waste sucrose from the production of treacle? Yeast extracts, such as Marmite, uses spent yeast from the brewing industry, and Bovril, a beef extract, was a byproduct of meat preservation. Chef Jenny Chandler thinks eating leftovers at home doesn't have to be a compromise or a chore. You can think of leftovers as being leftover ingredients at the source, where food first comes into your kitchen, or the leftover components of cooked meals, she says. Both are exciting and have the potential to be the kicking-off point for delicious dishes. Jenny suggests using recipes as a jumping-off point rather than a prescriptive guide to be followed to the letter. She encourages home cooks to substitute ingredients depending on the season and to make use of what they already have at home. For instance, a monthly sweep of any leftover nuts, seeds and dried fruits in the baking cupboard can be turned into breakfast granola. Or you can melt mixed nibbles of cheese languishing in the fridge into a pasta sauce. It's fun to play around with what you've got in the fridge or in your kitchen cupboard. It takes practice and confidence, but there's an immense sense of pride that comes from creating something great. Ellie Kirshen, a cook and food writer, is another taking the art of fridge forage seriously. Her rollover leftovers series of Instagram videos has inspired thousands to look with renewed vigour at waste in their kitchen. She owned a cafe in Bristol for over a decade and says stretching ingredients has both financial and environmental benefits. With every ingredient you bring into a business, you're looking to maximise the output. So I use the same approach at home. I suggest doing a regular audit of your fridge, freezer and cupboards. A stock take, basically, and also writing a weekly meal plan. You'll soon notice the savings building up week on week. Ellie is often surprised by the video content that her followers enjoy. Favourites include preserving feta cheese in brine in the fridge and freezing leftover chip shop chips and reheating them from frozen. Sometimes I worry that simple tips are hardly worth sharing, but to some they've been a game changer. Mrs. Beaton and her fellow home cooks, it seems, have still plenty to teach us.
To finish off this edition of the magazine, we have an on-the-spot report from our roving reporter, Beverly Hopkins, where she continues her chat with Mardler listener Arthur Barwick about times gone by.
Hello, Mr. Barwick. Thank you very much for inviting me to come back and talk to you again.
Now, a little story about the well. When we wound the water up in the bucket, we would stand the bucket on slab at the front of the well. And sometimes the cat would go to get a drink and it would knock the bucket down in the well and the cat fell in the well with it. We would know when the cat was in because we'd hear the bucket go down. It was on a chain and the chain used to rattle.
Right.
So we'd rush out, the cat was down the well and we'd get it in the bucket and wind it up. And it's no harm done to it. It was just me old and off it went.
But how often did that happen? It didn't learn.
Not many times to the same cat.
Oh, I see.
But we did have several cats.
Oh, okay. Okay.
In the village, in those days, there was very few cars. The doctor had one, the grocer had one, and the farmer had a car. That's the only cars we had. But we had a lot of tradesmen visiting. We'd have the baker. The baker would come in a horse and cart, and he'd bring all the news from round the village.
Gosh.
The postman would come on a bicycle and he would have all the news, he would chat. And the postman was a very talented drawler. And when us boys met him in the village on the road, he would jump off his bike and he said, "What would you like me to draw you today? A lion? A tiger?" And because we had the baker came, the fishmonger came, the man came with the oil. We had to have heating all for little stoves, and washing was a big thing for Mum. In a cauldron, I think you call it, up the corner with a stick fire underneath it to heat the water. And then it would be taken outdoors, so we used to have a mangle. It's a great big thing with a handle on it to turn it. Two big wood rollers. One of my sisters would be at the back to collect it when it went through. Mum would put it in the front, and quite often I would turn the handle.
Oh, that was your job?
Yeah.
Gosh, she must have had a lot of washing, your mum.
She did. And we were always clean. The girls had white ankle socks, and they was always very clean. And she cooked wonderful. We were so well fed.
Really?
It was very straightforward, plain cooking. But we had lots of cakes and things to fill us up.
Yeah,
and
was a
dumplings,
good,
they were very nice. Well, I try to make them nowadays, but I can't make them like she made them.
Nobody can cook like our mum.
No, I can't cook like her. No.
Oh.
And so we had a large common, a huge common, because Dad rented this little farm. And it was mainly gorse and bracken and heather that grew on the common. And there were little ponds on the common where Dad used to go with the horse, with the pony, and a tank on wheels to collect water to water the greenhouse.
Oh, right,
so it was
yeah.
all done by hand.
So you didn't want to use the precious well water?
We did, but they used to dry up in the summer. It was go so low, Dad wouldn't use it, watering the plants because we needed it for the house.
Of course.
So he would go down there. And in these ponds, it was full of fish. Sticklebacks, white throats, and there was also newts, different types of newts we used to catch. We used to tie a worm on the end of a piece of string on a stick and catch these newts, lovely newts. We put them in a jam jar so we could see them, full of water.
Oh.
And sometimes we took them to school.
Did you?
To show the people at school, yeah. The common was really lovely. I spent lots of time over there. And then it came time for me to go to school. I hadn't met many people. I was very, very shy because it was a very quiet little place where we lived. And so Helen, my second older sister, was going to take me to school. And we walked a mile and a half to the village school. And when I got there, I thought I was going to stay with Helen all day long. And he said, no, Helen has to go to her class. You have to stay here. And of course, I blubbered, didn't I?
Oh, you were frightened. Upset.
So they put me to play in the sandpit. They had a sandpit in the school with another boy. And this boy had ginger hair. I'd never seen ginger hair before. So I pulled it. So he pulled mine.
Oh.
And I learned very quickly it's not a good idea to pull people's hair. Now, for counting, the way they used to learn us was with beads. They had 10 beads on a wire rack.
Oh.
And you would move one bead at a time, and that'd be 1, 2, up to number 10.
Like an abacus.
Count the beads.
Like an abacus.
And they'd all gone one side, you'd count them back again.
Back again, yeah.
1, 2, 3, up to 10.
Yeah.
And that's how we learned to count.
Right.
And we learned to count very quick, actually.
Okay.
We used to love going to school.
Did you?
They did have school dinners, but I wasn't keen on school dinners. And so I used to run home from the school a mile and a half to have a...
At lunch?
Yes, to have my dinner at lunch
and run
back
again
to school. And we used to run home. My mother used to cook him a dinner.
Okay.
And we'd cook him, we'd have our dinner and we'd run back to school again. Our dress then in those days was very simple. It was Barwick, the common, Cranmere Road, Briston. The name Barwick apparently originated from a piece of land, because a small piece of land was known as a Barwick. So I found this out in Trace of the Family Tree. So our name originated from what they called a piece of land.
Oh, that was fitting, considering you were on a farm.
Yeah,
brilliant.
Yeah, Barwick.
Honestly, Mr. Barwick, this is so interesting. I'm sure our listeners would be thrilled to listen to it, and thank you so much.
And those items conclude this week's magazine supplement. Our thanks go to the authors of these articles for their contributions.
Returning to the news, our penultimate selection of news stories covers new toilets and digital screens, old candlesticks and a new model of an old boat, then crown bowls, cold calls and care home conversions.
North Norfolk District Council, NNDC, has given the nod to National Trust's proposals to modernise the toilets and improve the car park at Morstan Quay. While it originally hoped to replace the ageing portable toilet block with a much larger building, including a new visitor centre and offices for staff, the Trust was forced back to the drawing board after a backlash from locals. Hundreds objected on the council's planning portal, fearing the development would ruin the remote quayside, before the Trust withdrew its plans last July. Morstan Parish Council, which described the previous plans as abhorrent, raised no objections to the later scheme, which is around half the size. It said the Parish Council is pleased to support the application, subject to the assurance given by the National Trust to the Council that the car park will retain its current unmodernised look with a rough gravel finish, and that areas of planting and boundary posts, etc., may be removed after completion of the works. No other objections were received, in contrast to the previous plans submitted in 2024. The site lies within the Norfolk Coast National Landscape, a National Nature Reserve, and internationally important wildlife habitats. Natural England did not object, provided construction be carried out between September and November to minimise disturbance over wintering birds. The new single-storey building will provide permanent toilet facilities, staff toilets and a plant room. The project also includes the installation of improved foul drainage to replace the current septic tank. Other minor works include landscaping, a relocated waste bin enclosure, accessibility improvements and limited resurfacing of the car park. NNDC concluded the plans would not increase visitor numbers and would have minimal impact on the landscape.
Visitors to North Norfolk are benefiting from new digital information screens at train stations. The touchscreens have been installed at Cromer, Sheringham, Hoveton and Wroxham and North Walsham stations, providing easy access to maps, details of local attractions, events and onward travel connections. The project is supported by a £48,000 grant from Greater Anglia's Customer and Community Improvement Fund and is part of a wider visitor information initiative valued at more than £140,000. Andrew Hurd, Managing Director of Visit North Norfolk, said, "We're delighted to be working with our partners to deliver this exciting and innovative project to the towns of North Norfolk. It helps provide visitors with up-to-date information about the area and supports local businesses by providing a platform to highlight events, things to do, and businesses to visit." The screens have been developed through a collaboration between North Norfolk District Council, Norfolk County Council, and Visit North Norfolk. They also include live bus departure updates to improve connectivity for visitors travelling within the region. Scott Dolling, Partnerships Manager at Greater Anglia, said, "The Customer and Community Improvement Fund is designed to support projects that make a real difference to the communities we serve. This initiative will help provide consistent information for visitors using public transport while giving people more confidence to explore the fantastic destinations along the Bitten Line. Additional screens are being commissioned by the Broads Authority, Community Rail Norfolk, and an increasing number of destinations and market towns to further extend the visitor information network. By improving access to visitor information and onward travel, the scheme is intended to create more joined-up journeys that benefit residents and tourists alike."
A rare pair of 200-year-old Chinese porcelain candlestick holders has been discovered in North Norfolk. They were found during a recent Hanson auctioneer's valuation day near Rowton. The mid-18th century figures, expected to fetch up to £5,000 at auction, were discovered by Adam Skoon, the Asian art specialist known to viewers of the BBC's Antiques Roadshow. What a remarkable find in Norfolk, and what incredible survivors from around 1760, Mr. Skoon said. They both represent the extraordinary global trade that connected the Qing dynasty with fashionable homes in Georgian Britain. You can almost imagine them standing proudly on a mantelpiece in a Norfolk drawing room while guests admired these exotic treasures from the other side of the world. Each porcelain figure is painted in the Famille Rose palette and holds a torch-shaped vase designed to hold a candlestick. The pair would have been produced most likely in Canton for export to the European market. Charlotte Williams-Richardson, Associate Director at Hanson Norfolk, added, "This is a wonderful find right on our doorstep, and I am sure it will attract worldwide interest." The candlestick's journey would have been an astonishing one, created thousands of miles away, most likely in the workshops of Canton. The ladies would have travelled by ship around the Cape of Good Hope on ships laden with tea, silks, lacquerware and porcelain destined for Britain's growing merchant and aristocratic classes. Chinese export porcelain became highly fashionable in 18th century Britain, influencing everything from interior design to architecture and garden ornamentation. The newly discovered pair has undergone some restoration work, but remains notable for its finely modelled faces, flowing robes and intricate floral details. They will be sold at Hanson's Norfolk auction on August the 1st at the Old Bakery, Groveland, Thorpe Market Road, Rowton, with public viewing on July the 30th and 31st from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m.
A model maker has completed a detailed miniature of a historic wherry yacht. John Hollis, known for crafting steam and electric power models, decided to create a working sailing model for the first time. The result is the replica Narada, a detailed miniature of the Norfolk Broads wherry. The project involved detailed research and included handmade furniture, lighting, wash basins and galley fittings. Mr. Hollis said, "Sailing models had always intrigued me, yet I'd never attempted one. They're a very different proposition. You're dealing with balance, wind, rigging and sail handling, not just motors and propellers." Choosing Narada was a practical decision for the model maker. He was drawn to her unique boom-attached sail, more slender hull form and lower freeboard, which suited his model criteria. He also found the interior detailing most enjoyable, despite not being able to use ready-made fittings. The challenges of the project included creating his own plans due to the lack of existing drawings of Narada. The Blake Victory marine toilet also proved difficult, taking a significant amount of time and patience to assemble its around 75 individual components. Despite these challenges, Mr. Hollis is now enjoying sailing his model, noting how it behaves remarkably like the actual vessel. He said, "She's not the most practical model to operate, but once she's on the water, all that effort feels really worthwhile." Looking ahead, John has started on another historic vessel, the steam yacht Amazon, built in 1885. This vessel has a rich history, having taken part in Queen Victoria's Diamond Jubilee Fleet Review in 1897 and was once owned by actor Arthur Lowe. The real Narada is one of the five historic wherries maintained by Wherry Yacht Charter and is available for public sailing trips and private charters.
A Lawn Bowls Club is celebrating its 100th year. Overstrand Bowls Club, based in North Norfolk, began in 1926 and is believed to have originated at Overstrand Hall, a stately home designed by Edwin Lutyens for Charles William Mills. During the First World War, the hall was used as a military hospital before being sold for use as a convalescent home in 1932. Although exact records are limited, a photograph in the clubhouse dated 1926 suggests the club was founded around that time. Today, the club enjoys a scenic location overlooking the village cricket ground and its rare thatched pavilion. Overstrand Bowls Club currently has more than 40 active members and competes in three Norfolk leagues. It also hosts friendly roll-ups twice a week on Mondays and Fridays, and is encouraging new members to join. A spokesman for the club said, "Bowlers live longer. Don't think it's just an older person's game. It's a game for all ages and abilities. Come and join us for competitive sport, gentle exercise and social chatter."
An empty care home could be turned into more than a dozen Airbnb apartments, prompting fears from locals it will become a venue for wild parties. Felthorpe Parish Council has said the proposed transformation of Boundary House Care Home at the edge of the village will create disturbances if large group bookings are permitted. Locals say it could become a destination for stag or hen parties and that it could increase noise and antisocial behaviour. officials at Broadland District Council argue that although a total of 13 self-contained Airbnb are planned, there would be no single space for large groups to gather. They say the layout of the former care home in Haveringrand Road does not lend itself to parties. Additionally, only 40 people will be allowed on the site at any one time. Councillors are due to discuss the scheme by New Boundaries Group, which owns the home, at a meeting on Wednesday. The home, which looked after people with disabilities and autism, was shut down by the Care Quality Commission in October 2023, following concerns over the standards of care provided.
Locals in a Norfolk Broads village have been warned to be on their guard after reports of a rogue trader in their community. The alert from Norfolk County Council follows reports of doorstep cold callers offering roof repairs in the Potter Higham area. A man has been stopping at properties in the area, claiming he can see issues and offering to undertake repairs. A similar warning was issued for people living in the NR2 area of Norwich earlier this year, where men were believed to be distributing leaflets advertising a range of roof repair services. A spokesman for the council's trading standard said, "Our advice is to never agree to have work done by somebody who is just passing, or take their word that it needs to be done at all. Never allow a cold caller access to your home, roof or garden, even if they are offering to do small tasks for a small fee or free. When looking to have work done on or around your property, only deal with reputable companies you have researched and have chosen yourself, and have obtained a written quotation before commencing the work." Our last few articles cover a postie's post-retirement plans, a happy ending after the lifeboat is called out, and a rare bird sighted at Kelling draws in the birders and twitchers alike.
A much-loved postie has been given a heartfelt send-off after completing his final delivery. East Runton locals turned out in force to celebrate John Fowler's retirement after 18 years delivering post in the village. Around 90 people gathered by the village sign to wish him well. Mr. Fowler said, "The dogs have always been lovely in East Runton. I have loved working around here. Working in a village is brilliant because you get to know everybody. I am most excited to being able to wake up early in the morning and not having to go to work early in the morning." The surprise gathering included a retirement fund of nearly £450, a memory book and a large card signed by dozens of residents. The event was organised by villagers after Mike Ashwell, a recipient of Mr. Fowler's deliveries, suggested signing a card, and the idea quickly grew into a larger celebration. Mr. Ashwell said, "John is a wonderful chap, totally reliable. I will miss John being my postman. He always has a good word for everybody and always has a treat for the dogs. I think the dogs will miss him more than the people." Friends and neighbours clapped as Mr. Fowler arrived on his final shift and sang a rousing chorus of "He's a Jolly Good Fellow" when he was presented with his card and memory box. Gazebos were set up with tea and coffee, and neighbours gathered to share stories and laughter in the sunshine. One of Mr. Fowler's final tasks that day was helping the new postman learn the round. Mr. Fowler has lived in Cromer for 30 years.
The Cromer RNLI Inshore Lifeboat was launched at 9:48 p.m. on Thursday, July the 10th, after the Coast Guard tasked the crew to assist two people on paddleboards off the coast of East Runton. Kevin Johnson, RNLI Helm, said, "Paddleboarding is a fantastic way to enjoy the coast, but even on calm-looking days, conditions can change quickly. Offshore winds and tidal currents can carry paddleboarders away from the shore before they realise what's happening." RNLI volunteers arrived at the scene to find that the paddleboarders had managed to return safely to the beach and were already speaking with HM Coast Guard officers. The lifeboat then returned to the station and was readied for service. Mr. Johnson reminded people to plan ahead before going out on the water, especially during the hot weather. He said, "We always encourage people to check the weather and tide before heading out. wear a suitable buoyancy aid or personal flotation device and carry a means of calling for help in a waterproof pouch.
A super rare bird snapped by a wildlife photographer sparked a twitch of more than 100 birders to the North Norfolk coast. Keen bird watcher Adam Spruce from Cromer took a picture of a squawkle heron among the reeds in Kelling. The 26-year-old, who runs photography company Wild Eye Media, said it is definitely up there in the top three or five rarest birds I've ever spotted. The squawkle heron is a small pale brown heron of Mediterranean wetlands, so any appearance in Norfolk is often classed as a once-in-a-lifetime event for local birders. In the UK, it is classed as an exceptionally rare visitor, with only a handful of records nationally in most years, and often none at all in some counties. Mr. Spruce said that at least 100 birders flocked to the coast for a chance to see the bird, which he has described as super rare. The word got out in the groups that one was in the area. I was very lucky to see it, Mr. Spruce said.
And that brings us to the end of this edition of The Mardler, with readings from the North Norfolk News. If you have any comments or queries, you can contact our listener liaison officer, Imogen Waterson, on 01263 587 610.
Perhaps we should just mention that if you have a smartphone, tablet or computer, or know someone who has, you can listen to this and other editions online at mardler.org.uk. You can also use an Alexa smart speaker, a variety of smartphone apps, or even a telephone call to listen. Find out the details on our website, mardler.org.uk.
We rely on receiving your returned memory sticks and pouches so that we can continue to send you new editions each week. So please remember to return the pouch and memory stick promptly, making sure to reverse the address label first.
The sound engineer today was Daniel Butterworth. Editing and producing this issue was Trudy Box. Our colleagues in the copying dispatch room join us in wishing you the best of health, and we look forward to joining you again in a week's time. But for now, it's
cheerio! Cheerio.